This is the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast, where we're building Australia's largest and most comprehensive resource for Australian lure fishers. Join us every Monday, Wednesday and Friday as we break down the locations, the techniques and the tackle that you need to catch more fish on lures. Or visit our website, doclures.com, to get the free resources and tools that will help you to achieve the results that you want. So if improving your lure fishing is your aim, then settle in and enjoy the top information shared by our hosts and by top lure fishers from all around Australia.
Hi everybody and welcome to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast. I'm your guest host Andrew Deeth and on behalf of Greg Vinyl, I'm recording a series on targeting and hopefully catching big brim. Now today we have a guest who is a well-known Victorian angler who has made his mark on the Vic Brim Classics fishing with his dad. Now Paul has also fished a bunch of Hobie kayak tournaments where he's also won the chance to compete in the Hobie Fishing Worlds, which were held in Louisiana back in 2016. Paul runs a very informative and inspirational YouTube channel, which is well worth checking out. And Paul's most recent result was at the Gippsland Lakes round the Vic Brim Classics, where he and his father Alex recorded the all-time Big Brim bag. So it's now time to welcome back to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast, Mr. Paul Malov. Good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Andrew. Thank you for that lovely intro.
No worries. Did I get it all right?
Yeah, I think you got everything in. Yeah, very good. Definitely did your research.
Very good. Yeah, I had a good look. I looked back through your YouTube channel, which is really well worth checking out. There's a lot of tips, which I'm sure you'll go through some of those tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's just a bit of a shame I wasn't really into the vlogging side of things when we went over to Louisiana. That would have been a great one to capture.
Yeah, I think so. I looked online. What were you chasing over there?
We were chasing redfish.
Yep.
I think they're called speckled trout.
Uh-huh.
And flounder, I think, was our third species or the special species to try and catch as well. So, but redfish was the main one, and just due to its size, probably gave you the most points.
Yeah.
And then the trout was in that kind of 15-inch range.
Yeah.
And flounder, obviously, probably around the same. But the redfish got up to about, so I think some of the guys got up to 40, 42 inches.
Right.
Big fish.
Yeah, yeah. I remember watching at that time, trying to qualify myself for that. I remember watching a video, I think it was called Bulls on Top.
Yeah.
And watching these redfish smack lures off the top. So, yeah. All righty. So, mate, where I think we'll start is I'll get you to tell us a story, and this can be of your choosing. So, about either a big brim or maybe you want to go through your last win. I'll leave that up to you, which way you want to head.
Sure. Yeah, no worries. I'll start off with a big brim story, and it's one from Mallacoota. And then we'll just quickly touch on the Vic Brim Classic, I guess, the last event that was held in Gippsland Lakes.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I were chatting about it. It was pretty funny. One of the comments there, we'll come back to that one. But
yeah, okay.
One that really stands out for me, and it's probably something that we'll touch on later about like setup and line, is a really, really good roasting that I had at Mallacoota.
Yeah, okay.
This is probably going back a good 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
But one that's probably going to stay with me forever. And we pulled into this little pocket. It was all kind of tea tree, and then just flattened down to a bit of sand.
Yeah.
And so to the right of me was tea tree, about 50 metres away, and to the left, about 20 metres, was just rock and coral. And we just saw these big fins just right over the sand. And I thought, for a second, we thought it was a mullet. It would have been a good, I don't know, 10 centimetres wide across the back.
Wow.
And facing away from us.
Yep.
So facing the shoreline. And this thing was sitting in 30 centimetres of water. And just sitting there finning on the spot. And
yeah.
I had a unweighted camo worm on. I flicked that out to him about a meter to his left, led him to it,
yeah.
Swam right up to it, sucked it in, perfect hook set. And it was just the greatest roasting
really?
I can ever remember. He knew where those rocks were. He knew where the bit of timber was, and or he or she, and just absolutely drilled me.
Yeah.
And it was straight bounced straight through.
That was my next question. What were you running?
Right. So, yeah, I was running some light setups at the time. And look, I got plenty of good fish out on the 3 pounds, but this particular fish just knew exactly where home was.
Yeah.
It was a very, very memorable hookup.
Yeah.
and roast.
I mean, that's a dilemma with your fish light line to, you know, to get the bite, and then sometimes it just doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to get them out. So
that's right. Exactly. And, you know, some of your questions that you sent through prior to the show, do you try and go light to get the bite?
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back to the Vic Brim Classic that just recently ran, and couldn't be any more different, you know, in terms of the setups that we were now running, or in some systems where we now run, you know, 20-pound braid and up to 17-pound leaders to get these fish out.
Yeah.
And just don't really give them a chance, get them in the boat, in the net, and on to the next one.
Yeah, that
But yeah, the Vic Brim Classic was pretty special. You know, again, it's going to be one that we'll always remember, and something that you said, I think, to me after watching the video was, "Oh, we're not going to go, to Holland's Landing because they're only 1.2."
Yeah, yeah, I know, that was it was kind of a funny comment.
Yeah, I know. If you listen to it without kind of context, or you go, "Wow, really?"
Yeah.
But when you're comparing 1.4s and 1.5s to 1.2s, it was the right decision ultimately.
It was the right decision. Yeah, it's a pretty sad day when you can only get 1.2s.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I felt sorry for the guys. I had a look at the results.
Yeah.
After we spoke.
Yeah.
And I think you won by 50 grams. And then Wayne Hamilton and Andy Moore.
Yeah.
Mate, 13.73, and they're the bridesmaids. Mate, it's crazy.
Yeah, I think I said to you, I felt bad as well. Like, we were a bit stiff a couple of years ago, just before, I think just when COVID started, and we got 6.93 kilograms on the second day and still lost.
Yeah.
By a fair bit to Dan and Declan.
Yeah.
In another event down there at Gippsland Lake. So it's been kicking out some incredible bags over the last few years. The system's really getting better and better. And even now with the netters gone out of there, I think it's going to keep improving as the years go by.
Yeah, it's got to be a pretty attractive tournament venue where your average fish weight is 1.3 kilos plus. That's insane.
It was incredible. And the great thing was, it wasn't just a particular, you know, small area that was kicking out a ton of bags. The guys were getting them from all over the lakes, from one end to the other, pretty much.
Yeah.
Which was really pleasing to hear and see. So, no, really looking forward to going back to that system again.
Yeah, crazy. And look, later on, we'll get into the lures, and you can tell the listeners about what lines and line classes and lures you were throwing at them. And I think you also made a couple of modifications to what is an already a really good lure. So
Yeah.
All right. Let's get straight into it. So when I first started the concept for this podcast series, one of the things on targeting big brim or any brim is, first of all, you've got to know where to find them. So based on your experience, if you're targeting large brim, you're not targeting a bag fish, you're targeting large brim, what would be your favorite structures to fish? You know, it's boats, flats, rocky edges. Give us a bit of a rundown on where you would head.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've given that one a bit of thought, and there's probably no single answer for it. As a background, or as just a little comment about myself and the type of fishing that we do, like Dad and I started fishing a lot of jetties and docks and things like that around Melbourne.
Yeah.
Around Metro Melbourne. So structure was always something that we just enjoyed and knew how to fish.
Yeah.
And in a lot of systems that have that man-made structure, they do tend to hold some really good fish. So that's something that we always kind of gravitate to. But a lot of the systems, like Gippy Lake, doesn't always do what it just did a couple of weeks ago or a month and a half ago now. Those fish aren't always there. And water's a little bit clearer. They're a lot smarter too. So that doesn't happen all the time. But coming back to your question, there's probably two or three key areas that I look for, and that's going to vary by system.
Yeah.
But we'll start at the very front of a system. And I think anywhere you can get some good current or some good flow in and out, you're going to find brim as well, whether they're good yellowfin or blacks hanging back a little bit further, just away from the mouth. So places like Bam, Kuta, Tamboon, even like a little bit further back from lakes entrance, you'll find some really good patches of brim, especially big yellowfin coming in with those tides.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I will say about that is that it's not my hard body fishing or cranking is not my forte. I'm definitely more of a more of a soft plastics man, but it's something that I'm starting to do a little bit more of and really enjoying. Just really enjoying that hit on the hard body.
Yeah, okay.
Always, I think, as a starting point, anywhere you can find good current and good flow close to estuary mouth, you will find some good brim as well. And generally, you know, where there is some stronger flow, there'll be some bigger fish in that area. that's something that we always kind of look at.
Yeah, okay.
Whether I'm in a kayak or whether we're doing as a social or in a tournament situation. And the other one's really, I think, rock walls and snags, natural stuff. I think the combination of the food sources on both of those lends itself to holding bigger fish. I think, generally speaking, we do get some really good fish off rock walls.
Yeah, okay.
That's something that I've noticed or observed over a number of years.
Yeah. In terms of food sources, what are you referring to?
I think there's a lot of crab and a lot of shellfish.
Yeah, okay.
Still on those as well. So, and that's from one end of Victoria to the other for us. So the Glenelg River is a very, not sure if you fish the Glenelg yourself, but
not at all.
Beautiful limestone cliffs and just hundreds of kilometres of rock wall.
Yeah.
The small estuary down the front. So lots of rock wall options there. Hopkins River, likewise, lots of rock.
Yeah.
Coming back to Melbourne, we've got the Yarra River. It's got some great rocky structure close to the mouth where it flows into Port Phillip Bay. Holds some really, really good fish as well. And then likewise, as we start to head east, the same applies as we talked about earlier. So I think rock walls, anywhere you can find current and a rock wall, definitely going to hold big brim.
And so if you're coming up to a rock wall, are you looking for like a current hitting that at 90 degrees, or are you looking at like what's your preferred sort of current, like flowing along it, into it, eddies? Like,
Probably along it, to be honest, Andrew, but I don't get too technical with stuff, to be honest. I will say that.
Yeah.
I still tie double uni up.
You tie a double uni?
Absolutely.
Fair enough.
Yeah. That's a bit of a running joke for years now, but if that one comment alone tells you something, I don't tend to overanalyze things. But
yeah,
I just like a little bit of flow. Too much flow, they're not generally going to be there. I think if it's really pumping, they'll try and find a little eddy or a little hole, and they'll sit in that or behind a piece of structure or behind a rock.
Yeah.
And find those in situations where there is some strong current, so such as bridges, etc. Find those little eddies or places for them to hide. But if you've just got a gentle current, half a knot, maybe a knot, you'll find some brim. And then it's really around whether you're comfortable casting and pedaling against the current, or you're going to head downstream with it. And then that really just comes down to the way the fish position. But they'll generally tell you pretty quickly whether they've got a preference one way or the other, or if they don't really care. As long as there's some current, they're still going to eat and chase that lure down.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. So if we go back to the docks and the man-made structure, I want to watch the Vic Brim video you put up on YouTube.
Yeah.
One of the thoughts I watched, and you position your boat sometimes really, really close to the docks, or closer than I thought. Do you sort of have any comments on that? Like, usually I'm trying to cast as long as I can, but it seems to be a different setup there. And you obviously caught the fish, so, it wasn't wrong.
Yeah. I think that was probably a result of pre-fish, to be honest. We were able to get pretty close and it didn't seem to make any difference. So I think that was to help us get the cast into those little holes right underneath the jetties.
Yeah.
Where we thought would give us the best chance of getting fish and then ultimately having to skull drag them out to get them in the boat.
Yeah.
But because of the dirty water and keeping quiet with that Lowrance Ghost electric motor, it just allowed us to get a little bit closer than the previous years, I think.
Yeah, very good. Very good. It reminded me of Chris Hickson went around at Woi Woi about pre-COVID, so about 2019 maybe.
Yeah.
And the videos on that, maybe it was 2018, the videos on that, where they did the live streaming, I'm pretty sure, and he'd have to clarify this, he was nose into the docks, flicking in between the cracks and crevices and structure.
Yeah.
I remember Steve Field saying that he was doing bow and arrow cast, you should see this stuff. Anyway, he won that.
Yeah, I'll have to try and track it down. That's a good one. Funny because I think Chris, Babs, and I tend to fish very similarly.
Okay.
Russell Barbecue, because, a lot of those boys fish that Port Macquarie, Foster kind of area and a lot of rack fishing and actually grew up watching a lot of the AFC stuff with the boys in it and definitely two guys that I always kind of looked up to. And in the end, I think our techniques tend to be relatively similar in especially our gear choices with the slightly beefier rods and reels and line and leaders.
Yeah. I know from watching the video, I know what you're going to tell me about fishing the docks and pontoons down there and I'll recant a story then about about, I can't think, Daniel Brown, when he won the Hobie comp up there, what he did, it was not dissimilar to the way you fished.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
So, yeah. All right. What about tides? Like, how do they affect where, like, if you're fishing a comp, which I presume most of your fishing is geared towards, maybe not, how do the tides affect where you start and finish? So maybe if you go back to Gippsland, if it made a difference there.
Yeah. Look, with Gippy Lake, I don't think it makes that much of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually thinking more of a kind of social question on in regards to that, or answer to the way that I approach my like trips.
Yeah.
Side of comps, actually, funnily enough.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think most comps, they, from what I've observed about tournaments, especially locally, they try and time that you do get some float throughout the day, whether it's a, you know, a high tide in the morning or a high tide in the arvo.
Mm-hmm.
You're always fishing both parts of the day.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I do isn't so impacted by it.
Yeah.
A lot of it is slightly more stagnant water. As I said before, I don't do a lot of that stuff down the front of the system. If there is a really good tide change and some good conditions with it where it's not classy calm, I will try and fish that lower reaches of a system in a comp.
Yeah.
But when I look at opportunity to get out for a social fish on the weekend or before work, whatever, always try and find it or try and time it to a day where I've got definite flow. So halfway through a tide change, for example.
Yeah.
Really like the run up to a high.
Okay.
Or coming off a high, you know, about an hour and a half, 2 hours off the top of the high where you've got some really good outgoing water.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, I think the current definitely helps to get them to eat. Outgoing tide just dirties the water up a little bit. And again, makes it a little bit easier for you to approach them, get a little bit closer. And I think it does help getting them to feed as well. So it's definitely something that I look for.
Yeah.
A couple of the really close local systems always tend to fish well around those times too. And they tend to be good, solid fish and kind of in line with what I like doing, throwing, you know, mussels and crabs around structure, around the Paterson River. That tide change and a couple of hours either side tend to work really well. Something that I always look for.
Yeah. Okay. In addition to that, I think I sent this question through to you, so it's a little one off the cuff. How do you go about preparing for either a comp or a social day? Like in terms of what are you doing the night before? Are you just throwing the hook on the boat up and then you're off to go, or do you have a special plan?
No, I'm pretty meticulous. I will say, especially for a comp, I'm a shocker.
Yeah.
So for about 3 weeks out, the prep start, I'll look at long range forecast. I'll see how much rain they've had. I'll think about the time of year that we're having this event in. Try and access the memory bank, go through previous comp results, write up videos, pretty thorough in that regard. Then I'm an absolute shocker for buying more tackle.
Yep.
I think I'll need it and I'll throw it.
Yep. Fair enough. Yep, right there with you.
So there's Adam, there's Fishing, Gone Fishing, which is our local complete angler, Mo Tackle, whoever has what I think I might need.
Yeah.
I will generally stock up. I think I'm at that point now, though, where I feel like I've got most things covered.
Yeah.
That should be good in the future. But, yeah, the prep really starts a long way out for me.
Yeah, okay.
And I think also because I just get so excited these days, you know, I don't get the opportunity to fish as much as I used to. So tinkering away and just making sure that I've condensed my hard bodies and my vibes and things like that to a good manageable amount these days without having to take absolutely everything with me.
Yeah.
But then that just gives me that opportunity to review, are all my hooks, you know, sharp, make sure I haven't got any rusty hooks in there, change trebles and split rings if I need to. And then again, coming back to that plan, am I going to be fishing flat? We're going to be fishing deep. We're going to be fishing structure. And then that, with that, looking at the rods and outfits that we're going to take.
Yeah.
So I think Gippsland, I ended up taking 11 outfits with me to the comp.
Okay.
But I think Dad was at about 9. So we're running 20 rods, 20 outfits on Friday pre-fish before we really kind of figured out what we wanted to do. A lot of the outfits, again, coming back to that comp, where we're not fishing your traditional brim outfits. We're not fishing your 1-2-3s or 2-4 kilo outfits there.
Yeah.
3 to 6 kilo sticks, essentially.
Yeah.
And so we've got a number of those to then have various options of lures already tied on with heavy leaders to be able to just pick up and swap and change throughout the day And then you've got a couple of light rods, you know, in case you want to do some flat, a couple of light rods for your cranking or your twitch baiting. So it all starts to add up, and next minute you've got 11 outfits in the boat. But thankfully after Friday, we're able to cull that number down to a more manageable 6 or 7.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a lot. I did watch one of your videos and I remember looking at the back of the boat. I think your dad was standing at the back and in between about probably 10 or a dozen rods all laid out the back of the boat. I'm like, I hope he doesn't fall over. He's going to spend 20 grand.
Yeah, that's probably the only downside to that Renegade is the the storage options in that boat. Great all-rounder. Ripper little all-rounder.
Yeah.
But for that many rods and reels and outfits, it's not ideal. But we may do.
Yeah, well, you may do quite well. I've noticed that one of the key things about really good anglers is often the preparation. They spend a decent amount of time doing it and they're not going out with last week's or last month's or last year's knots all tied on. Everything's new and good to go. So I think you'd probably fit that mold.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing I don't never try and kind of skimp on is making sure I've got fresh leader for the practice days and comp days. Like there'll be times where I'll check knots, and if it's been a recent trip, you know, within the last month or so when I've got pre-fish, I might run the same gear.
Yeah.
But that Friday night, I'll do every single rod.
Yeah. I think that's important.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. The next thing is, do you keep a diary?
I don't.
You don't?
No, I don't. I've never kept one. Yeah, it's an interesting one. While my memory's still pretty good, I'm okay, I guess, in that kind of regard.
Mm-hmm.
Always bouncing ideas off dad and, just chatting about fishing here and there. You know, do you remember that time we did this and that worked, or well, that didn't work? And continuing to build that up, I guess, just with social media as well, uploaded thousands of photos over the years and trip events. So there's always a little reminders as well.
Yeah, yearly.
Which has been really helpful. Yeah, that kind of this time last year or this time 8 years ago. And that stuff comes up regularly enough that I tend to remember where I've been and what I've done. But no, it's one that I've thought about doing, but never around to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have good record keeping systems, so I'm right there with you. But what I have done is, I think about 12, 18 months or maybe 2 years ago that Greg had Fishing Points advertising on here.
Yep.
And I started taking photos and I found that to be awesome. Like you can take an old photo, and based on the timestamp, if you know where it was, you punch it into the app and it'll tell you what the weather was, what level of the tide was at that day, like whether you were up, you know, rising at 1.2 or whatever.
Oh, wow.
All the current information.
Yeah, right.
So you can put, you know, photo, lure, all the stuff. And it's actually pretty quick. So I've been doing that for a while too.
I might have to look into that one. Brilliant.
It's worth it for about $30. It stores it on your phone. It doesn't go to the cloud. So yeah, definitely well worth a look.
Beautiful.
All right. Well, there you have it. Now it's time to talk about lures. Now I'm going to pretend that we're going to talk about three lures only, but I'm sure it's going to go way more than that. So how about you? Let's start with three.
I did think about it. Yeah. I reckon it'd have to be five for me.
Yeah, we can work with five, but we'll pretend it's three. But we're talking big brim. So tell me what's on your mind.
Yeah. Boy, it's hard to overlook what we've been using more recently. Callum's Mask Outback, like it's obviously changing the game a little bit, much like what Easy's Crabs did, you know, all those years ago.
Yeah.
I won't give any kind of rankings or what I think is, you know, my top five or my favourite. But I think over the last, say, 10 years, the lures that have caught me and us as a team, the most big brim would have to be a grub. Like a Z-Man grub, for example.
Yeah.
A paddle tail, like a Slim Swim or one of Naughty's Hurricane, a Cranker Crab, so olive or blue, some of my favourite colours. That's the green and the black.
Yeah.
With the orange belly and eyes, I think.
Yeah.
Callum's Muff.
Yeah.
And then it would have to either be the Damiki Monster Miki, which is a little creature bait, 2.5-inch little creature bait.
Yeah.
With little, you know, tentacles and long legs, or the or the gulp camo worm.
Okay.
If I include all those, that's six.
And that's not to mention stick minnows, atomic cranks, bent minnows.
Yeah, and it's not including the Range Vibe, Bass Day Range Vibe.
Range Vibe.
Not including the Rangy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not including the jackal chubby bob.
Oh, yeah, the jackal chubby, yeah. There's a lot there, but I mean, some of those can be grouped.
These days, yeah. But as I said earlier, you know, I am predominantly soft plastic, so, and a lot of structure. So for us, a sinking lure,
yeah,
like a vibe or a crab or a stick bait. But
yeah,
over the years, it's really been like structure fishing and just using our electronics a lot. And I know that's probably something that we'll talk about in a bit more detail, but
yeah,
just even out in the mud or out on the sand at systems like BEM and Mallacoota and places like Tamboon and things like that.
Yeah.
You really rely heavily on your electronics, especially at certain times of the year when those fish really do group up.
Yeah.
And then that's where things like, you know, your slim swims and your grubs really come into their own.
Yeah. Well, let's go into that now. We'll come back to sponsors later, but you're at Team Lowrance.
Yeah.
Tell us about what's going on there, how it helps you, and just, you know, give them a shout out.
Yeah. Oh, look, so I think any site imaging technology is just absolutely fantastic. So for anyone who's listening, I think if you can, I guess, save up or get a unit which allows you to scan out to the side, save you a lot of time finding fish. You no longer have to drive over that school of fish or that individual one or two fish using your traditional sonar to hopefully get that arch up on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, you can now scan out 20, 30, 35 meters out to each side of the boat effectively. And using, I guess, the generally speaking, for most units, with the Lowrance ones, everything's pretty much touch, just like your mobile phone. So it's super simple to identify a patch of fish, you know, put your finger on those fish, create a waypoint, then switch your screen to like a split screen where you've got the map and the sonar and the side imaging all on the same screen, and then line up your boat or kayak to effectively then fish that school that you just found on the side imaging. So without it, I think we'd, I wouldn't say we'd be, you know, really struggling, but I think it's really saved and has made our fishing a lot more efficient over the years, especially on that Friday practice day.
Yeah, okay.
It allows us, I've often said it after tournament, I will punch in 200 to 400 waypoints on a tournament weekend.
Yeah, okay.
Especially those times where there's lots of fish out in the open on those flats.
Yeah.
I will just punch waypoints and then make sure that when I'm drifting, out, you know, using the wind, etc., that I'm going over those areas where I've seen fish previous day or same day, whatever it might be, and that I think helps me go over productive areas quicker or more effectively, I guess.
Yeah. So can I circle back?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, can I circle back? So a couple of things. So first, what I heard you say was that you'll mark fish on the side scan. So you tap it on the screen, then flick screens back to one where you've got your map up, and then angle your boat to turn around and target straight at that school or fish or whatever you've seen.
Correct.
Okay, so that must mean I'm trying to work out, like with your map page, have you got the boat set up so you've got a sort of a pointer out the front of it so you can see which way it's pointing? Is that how it works?
Yeah, we do have a 0.1 GPS puck on the Quintrex, but I don't have one on the kayak. I mean, with the way that the waypoints are created and set, and I guess just knowing, having some spatial, I guess, awareness of where you've just been, how far you pedaled or drifted since you saw that school, also just allows me to line myself up quite easily. That probably comes with a little bit of experience and just time out on the water. So it's not critical to have the technology to then help you, I guess, point, as you kind of mentioned, you know, ensure that your boat swings and points in real time with whatever the wind's doing and what you're doing to then line yourself up. But it's also using, I guess, nature and the environment around you. If you're close enough to some structure, you go, oh, I was near that tree when I went past and saw those fish.
Yeah, okay.
On the side imaging. So I know that they're just off that tree, about 10 metres off the bank, et cetera, et cetera. So I try and use technology as well as, you know, the nature kind of around me and just observation skills of how far I might have drifted after I punched in that last waypoint.
Yeah.
Or I start turning the kayak, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To then help me. And again, it's not an exact or a perfect science, right? We're trying to minimize our time looking, but
yeah,
it gives me a really great starting point. I might not hit them on the first cast. I might have to fan two or three or four casts, but I know I'll be in an area where there's fish for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So it enables you to paddle or motor up a river and scan it, say a 50-meter strip.
Yeah.
And hopefully be able to pinpoint if there's a school or a bunch of fish sitting in a certain area.
100%. 100%.
And just in technically, in terms of someone who's not very good with their electronics, how do you go about really getting to be able to see those fish on the side scan? Like, is it just practice? Are you spending a lot of time fiddling around with all the contrast and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, not so much. So I used to be 100% manual. So I used to set every little setting. But these days I do tend to run a lot of auto plus or minus.
Yep.
And I'll talk about that in a second. So again, coming back to, I guess, the setup. So I was really quite generic around it and never a plug for Lowrance. But as we said, you know, I am on the Lowrance Pro team, and I'll quickly just chat about the setup on both the kayak and the boat, and then we'll talk more about the actual, I guess, configuration and the setup and how I go about with every trip out on the water.
Yeah.
So on the kayak, over the years, you know, I've run pretty much every Lowrance unit that's been available. I think the optimal size, if you can swing it, is a 9-inch unit. I think that's really the best little sweet spot for good clarity, especially if you're side imaging in a kayak.
Yeah.
A 7's okay, and I think a 12 is just too big.
Okay.
I toyed with the idea for this season to run a 12.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad that I stayed with a 9. I had a 12 at home just to kind of compare and put up. It was just too big for me. It was just going to get in the way. I always run a lot of rods in the Pro Angler.
Yeah.
So I knew, you know, 6 to 8 rods in the Pro Angler in the tubes. Plus a 12, it was just going to get too much.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy I stuck with a 9. And I've been recently running the Elite FS unit, probably the last 18 months. And I've just recently switched over to the HDS Live.
Yep.
But I think value for money, that Elite FS combo with the 3-in-1 active imaging transducer is just super hard to beat.
Yeah, okay.
For the listeners, I shot a little video about the Elite FS with a kayak and the active target module and transducer for the Lowrance page and on my YouTube page. So if you guys want to check that out,
yeah,
have a look after this podcast, and I'll quickly talk about some of those features. And the great thing is, as Andrew and I have been chatting, some of those things and some of the features that we've been talking about, they're all built into the Elite FS unit at a really good price point. It's around the $1,500 mark for side scan, down scan, traditional sonar, mapping included, built in, so you don't need an extra chip.
Yeah.
And which has the ability to also integrate with that live imaging,
yep,
which is active target in the Lowrance range of products.
Yeah, so you'd be able to do pretty much anything with that.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. And the only reason I really switched over to the HDS Live was for that slightly better screen and slightly faster processing. And I think the pixel count was a little bit better on the HDS Live 9 versus the Elite FS 9. So I'm just hoping that that just gives me a little bit more of an advantage when using the active target, when using the live technology.
Yeah.
On the slightly better, faster unit. So this is the first time I've actually been running the live in the kayak ever.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the boat side of things, where it's a pretty tricked out Quintrex Renegade. So on the console, the HDS Live 12. And then on the back, on the transom, we've got the 3-in-1 active imaging transducer, which kind of does it all.
Yep.
And then more recently, in the last 6 months, I added a 60-inch Lowrance Ghost trolling motor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Two lithium batteries. We'll talk about the lithium that powers the kayak one as well.
Yep.
A 16-inch HDS Live up the front.
Yeah.
A GFAB engineering pole, an active target module. So there's really no excuse now on that, on that Quintrex. Got all the gadgets and gizmos to find those fish.
Yeah.
And give us the best chance at getting them in.
Yeah. So that means you've basically got everything.
Just about.
I can't.
Just about.
Yeah.
No room for a radar dome on that boat though.
Fair enough. I'm sure you'll cope. I'm sure a lot of the people out there listening will be interested to hear about the active target. So what are your thoughts on that, and tell us about it?
Yeah. So if you don't mind, I'll just quickly finalize that last question that you and I were just chatting. In terms of my setup, so as I said, I've really gone quite, I'm really happy with the way that the units process the water clarity on the auto mode. But what I do tend to do is all my sensitivity on my normal sonar, I tend to run them at auto plus 4 to 6. So I actually prefer to have a little bit more clutter on the screen. And the reason for that is, on the traditional sonar where you are looking for arches or partial arches or blobs, it's great to have a nice clean screen. But what it means is that you're missing fish. You're you're going over fish and your sounder is just not playing it back to you because your settings are too far kind of pulled back in order to display those partial arches.
Okay.
So I really like to put up with a little bit of extra clutter, you know, mid-water column, top-water column. I don't really tend to care about that.
Yeah.
What I'm looking for, especially down here in Victoria, the majority of our brim are sitting in that bottom third of the water column. So if I'm finding arches or seeing partials, I know there's fish.
Sure.
I always run a split screen. I'll run my side imaging across the entire length of the bottom.
Yep.
And then on the top two panels, I'll run down imaging on one side and traditional sonar on the other.
Yep.
If I'm seeing an arch or a partial arch on my traditional sonar and seeing a little white rice grain or a dot or a white blob on the down scan, I'm 100% confident that they're fish.
Yeah.
In terms of your question with side imaging, Andrew, and you know, finding that confidence, I think that's the biggest thing. It comes down to a little bit of time on the water, spending that time and being confident. It does help if you can go out with someone and learn to kind of show you that what you're seeing is what you believe it is, so to speak. Like, and what am I seeing? Are these fish? Is this structure? Is this digs, holes, etc.?
Yeah.
It does fast track your learning, but there's a lot of resources online now, on YouTube especially, so many videos of guys who show you this stuff these days.
Mm-hmm.
I probably recommend, especially new users or people relatively, what's the right terminology, not so confident with their sounder, whichever brand, whether it's Lowrance, Hummingbird, Garmin, there's so many resources out there. Strongly recommend spending a lot of time on YouTube. Have a look. Try and find a video with another user or a content creator who's got the exact same sounder as you, and try and find and really key in on those videos where they show the screen or some screenshots of what to look for and what fish look like in their environment. Try and get a scale or a bit of an understanding of size. So are they showing you, you know, catfish or big carp or little crappie, which the Americans call, which are like, I guess, like somewhere between our brim and perch.
Yeah.
Just to get that sense of scale, like what am I looking at? Am I looking at something really big, really small? Are they bait fish? Are they predators, et cetera, et cetera? But the more time you spend doing that, the more time you go out in the water and just putt around, so to speak. And the biggest tip that I give to people is try and learn your sound around structure.
Okay.
I think that's the easiest way to dial everything in, especially for people using active targets. I think this is just a really good segue in. I think dialing in your sound around structure, especially for side imaging, go and scan some bridges. Go and scan the boat ramp.
Yeah.
Like, play around with your range on the side imaging, so you can, you know, bring it in, extend it out, see what that looks like. See visually how far you are off the bank until you can see the boat ramp.
Yeah.
Or you can see the bridge pylons. And then as you're halfway through, quickly change the range and see what that does to the image. If you're happy with it, are you seeing more, are you seeing less, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, I think that's the biggest tip, to dial it in, have a play around in structure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with phones in our pockets and what have you, you can sit on the water, you can watch a YouTube clip and then try and go and replicate it while you're out there. So there's probably no excuse apart from spending.
Oh, I don't know what I would have done without a smartphone 10, 20 years ago. Like, there's just so many situations that saved me.
Yeah.
How to do this, how to do that. But a lot of content out there now and more getting published each day. So it's incredible.
Yeah.
But coming back to target, look, it's been a steep learning curve the first couple of sessions. Now, you and I were chatting about it ages ago before I had an opportunity to get mine set up. Now, have you played with it yet?
Sure. I have. And yeah, I've struggled with it, to be honest. I've found, like, I spent a lot of time just staring at the screen. What I did like about it is I was able to see how the fish reacted to a lure, even if they didn't hit it.
Yeah.
You'd often see the lures, the fish, like if it was a school of fish, swarm around it and then watch it and then swim away. And I also liked, it showed me how fishing with a slack line or like connected to your line, how that affected the drop of the lure, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
So that were my observations.
And was that on scout or was that on forward mode?
No, I was on forward mode.
Okay.
I didn't use it in scout at all, so I've got to get back to that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, my observations were when I first went out on the water, first of all, my transducer angle was not 100% right.
Okay.
So I needed to adjust mine a little bit. And thankfully, the by having it on a pole,
yeah,
you can offset some of that installation issues.
Sure.
By using angles on the pole.
Yeah.
So that can definitely get you out of trouble and optimize your image. But the couple of things for me was I started using Active Target out in open water on scout mode.
On scout mode.
Yeah, on scout mode, in like a meter and a half, 2 meters. And the thing was, as soon as I put it down, I saw fish swimming around in real time. Great, I'm seeing fish.
Yeah.
But the hardest part for me was trying to locate where those fish are in front of me or around me.
Yeah.
In scout mode with nothing, with no point of reference.
Sure.
Like no hard structure, no branch, no tree, no pylon. No rock wall that I can kind of bounce off and go, oh, right, they're just there, or they're a couple of meters to the left or to the right of it.
Mm.
But whereas around pontoons and jetties, I think scout mode was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because coming in, say, again, just thinking back to first trip, coming inside the gates of the Patterson Lake, which is like a man-made canal system for us here, and just standing under pontoons, I was able to see which part of the pontoon those fish were sitting under.
Yeah.
Was it the front point? Is it all along? Is it underneath that little L-shaped kind of connection where the straight pontoon meets with the perpendicular pontoon that runs back to the shore, etc.? So I was able to scan and look around and go, right, this is where they're sitting. And for me, again, it just came back to, I know I'm going to use a lure that's quite effective in this area. It was about finding sections of the pontoon that were holding fish.
Okay. That's accurate. With I've been an angler on the waters, Carl State from Yak Hunters.
Yep.
And he showed me some images of exactly that, of fish swimming around under a pontoon. You could see exactly where they were. Yeah, really good to see. And it ties in exactly with what you've just said.
Yeah. You know, and then thinking back to the Hobie event at BEM earlier this year, again, I went out there using Scout and I really struggled. Like I could see fish all around me. And with the small plastics that we use, it's really, depending on the range that you've got it out at, you're only seeing that plastic after a little while. I'm not seeing it on the whole cast. I'm seeing it probably halfway back in, maybe two-thirds of the way back to the kayak. One of the boys, Ben Shuey, he really said, you know, and he'd been running the Active Target on his for a little while as well, but he'd been running it in forward mode.
Yeah.
And as you know, BEM's quite shallow, so I thought, quite surprised to hear that, but since I made the switch at BEM to forward facing, I've really been impressed with it for brim fishing. I think that actually helped me in that comp, especially on day two, where I was able to identify that the fish were actually suspended. They weren't really tight to the bottom. So I actually went down a jig head size. So I went to like a 1/20th or 1/24th and fished it kind of mid-water, a plastic. And I did really well in that with that technique, and that was actually all due to Active Target forward facing. So I was able to kind of line up and knew exactly where those fish were, because, you know, with forward facing, the angle is much narrower. So you know wherever you're pointing, what you're seeing.
Yeah.
So I was able to make those accurate casts and see it on active as that plastic sunk down and kind of twitch it, keep it in the water column where those fish were sitting and getting the takes. So that was great.
Yeah, it's good to hear when the technology helps you put a fish in the boat. I think there's nothing better.
Yeah, it didn't help me with the big one, but it helped me get some fish in the boat.
Oh, well. I mean, I always find it good when you see fish on the sounder and you either turn around and maybe throw back down your bubble trail and catch a fish and you go, right, that was exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah, exactly. No better feeling.
Yeah, so just to summarize in like two sentences, you kind of prefer the scout mode under more your docks and pontoons and boats and that sort of area, and you're forward facing in the areas where you've got no points of reference.
That's right.
Okay, perfect.
But I've still got a lot of learning to do on that Active Target, especially in some slightly deeper water and some of our bass reservoirs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Really keen to use that forward and down scan technology to see how they react.
Yeah, I'd say in the deeper areas, the down's going to be pretty interesting, especially when you are fishing almost under the boat, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Well, mate, that was a good little segment on electronics. I think it's an area where a lot of people struggle, even if they do have all the good gear.
Yeah, look, it can be intimidating. Like, there's no denying it. And with technology changing so much these days, but I think all three major manufacturers are coming out with some really good stuff. I think the Lowrance products that are just really intuitive and really user-friendly.
Yeah.
From someone who's around technology every day, mobile devices, iPads, that kind of thing, it's very similar, especially the Elite FS or Elite Ti2 onwards. Everything's pretty much touchscreen, zoom to inch to zoom, that kind of stuff, which a lot of users and customers will be familiar with their kind of regular smartphone. So
yeah,
definitely worth a look.
Yeah, I think so. The only thing that I think they're missing, we now need a camera in them so you can just look at the screen, hold your fish up and take a photo. I reckon that'd be awesome.
Ah, there you go. There's one for the future feature roadmap.
I was going to say.
I'll pass that one on.
Fair enough. All right. That was a really good segment on electronics. I really appreciate that. Let's circle back to our lures. Let's go to the muss and maybe talk to us about how you fish that at Kippy Lakes and, you know, all the tackle and stuff that you use for that, because it was a bit specific.
Yeah. So with Kippy Lake, we pretty much fished it like a plastic and the bite changed every day. That was actually the most interesting observation for us is we got a lot of fish on the Friday pre-fish off single poles. I think over the weekend, we would have hit 50, 60 poles, and I think I only got one fish off them doing that. Then the majority of fish were either tight under pontoons and jetties. You had to really get that muscle like a meter in into that shadow and let it sink on a slack line so that it's fallen into that area underneath the pontoon. And often you'd get a take as soon as it hit the bottom, and they'd pluck it just like they do a plastic. That's really that tick in the line.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they'll have both sets of trebles pinned either side of the mouth. So they just grab it kind of halfway and both sets of hooks go in. So you get really good hookup rates with them.
Okay. So do you think they're hitting it off the bottom, or halfway down?
They were definitely picking it up off the bottom as well, Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So that thing lands with the hooks down. So they've picked the whole thing up and still ended up with hooks in their mouth.
Yeah, they picked the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Yep. One of the interesting things is because Gippsland Lakes has had so much fresh over the last 6 or 12 months, all or 99% of the mussels have actually died around the lake.
Right.
So there's just that much shell on the bottom.
Yep.
You pick it up every third, fourth cast and you get a bit of mussel shell back.
Okay.
So we were actually wondering if the mussel was, you know, kind of a reason for them, or they thought that, hey, here's a live mussel that's just kind of fallen off. I've got one chance to get it before another broom does, because they're so conditioned or used to just chewing them off the poles and off the jetties and hadn't seen them for a while because they're all dead. Perhaps that was another reason why it fished so well. That was such an effective technique for us. But otherwise, if we weren't getting hit off the poles as it sunk down and your line just stopped halfway down, that was a good indicator to strike. You'd get a tick just as it hit the bottom. And the other technique was we slowly just hopped them out like we do with plastics. Just a little lift and drop, lift and drop, lift and drop. And we had 1.5s coming out to 2.5 meters out from pontoons and jetties and still plucking it off the bottom.
So they're following it back as it leaves the structure?
Yeah.
Right.
Because often with other plastics or other techniques, for some reason, you know, we'd wind in and cast again. But for whatever reason, we just kept slowly hopping them out and they kept eating. So
yeah.
It just worked out. Yeah.
On that particular comp, tell us, workers, take us through the rods and reels and line that you're using for that comp.
Sure. Yeah. So rods and reels, rods are Miller Rods Beastbusters. So these are custom 3 to 6 kilo rods that I had made up by Ian probably a good 5 years ago now for this kind of fishing. So they're a 7 foot, 3 to 6 kilo, one piece rod. And I've got those paired up with 2,500 Diorixis and 20-pound braid. And for the most of the weekend, I ran 11 or 14-pound leaders. I think I ran 14 for the most of the weekend.
Yeah, which is pretty heavy.
Yeah, yeah. So we dropped one fish for the whole entire weekend, and that fish popped out on 11-pound leader on the same outfit. And so in terms of drag, I guess, you know, I don't know exactly. We never kind of adjust our drags with a set of scales or anything like that, but I'd say it was a couple of kilograms of drag at least that they would have to pull off to get any line from us. It was pretty tight. It's not like lock it down with pliers tight, but it was super tight.
Yeah, pretty tight. while the muscle has come out with pretty decent tackle, you actually played around with the hooks and rings a bit?
Yeah, I noticed some split rings starting to open up on Friday night. So we got off the water on pre-fish, had a look at a couple of them, and splits weren't, they're not really made for the pressure that we were putting them under with the outfits that we just discussed and the type of fishing that we were doing in that particular situation. So I changed all the splits and all the trebles. I don't know exact kind of specifications, but I think the decoy split rings, probably around that 5 to 8 kilogram kind of breaking strain range, and size 12 SC36 owner hooks, owner trebles.
Yeah. So you've just upgraded a bit.
Yeah.
Just because you're using heavy leaders and tight drags, which is a little bit more unusual.
But mind you, I probably changed for a good 15 sets of trebles over the weekend.
Okay.
Even with, like, they still last sometimes just one fish and that's it.
Yep. Yeah. And they're just mangled?
Yeah, they're just bent out.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think even the 12s really aren't made for that, but it's worth it in the long run when you get that W.
So no, that's exactly right.
That effort in the boat and sit back, you let that adrenaline kind of cool down for a minute, get the shakes, get over it, change some trebles, go back in.
Yep, that's it. And you've got the confidence too. There's nothing worse than hooking up to what you know is a big fish and you go, oh, gee, I wish I didn't bend that hook back. Wish I'd have just popped a new one on.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, especially on comp days. On Friday, I was a bit more loose with that.
Yeah.
I'd bend a couple back or fish with one bit bent out. You don't care as much, but Saturday, Sunday, I'll definitely take that time to change.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the first lure ticked off the list. Now we've got about 7 left. Do you want to go with maybe group your Z-Man grubs and maybe your paddle tails together? Or is that the wrong thing to do?
No, I think you're bang on there. It's pretty straightforward, pretty simple kind of stuff. Tend to fish them on a 1/16 or a 1/12 for the most part.
Hidden weight or jig head?
Jig head. I have started to fish them around like more rocky areas on a hidden weight.
Yep.
And if I need to skip under structure, a hidden weight jig head definitely helps, and that horizontal sink rate can often be really good.
Yep.
But I found in some of those situations or systems that we spoke about earlier in East Gippsland, just a traditional jig head's perfectly fine.
Sure. And what brand are you using? What brand and size?
For the most part, I think I'm like 99% TT. But I often use the heavy gauge hooks. I don't use the fine points or anything like that.
Yep. So it's a heavy wire.
Yeah, the heavy wire. Yep. I've got some leftover atomics that have always been really good.
Yep.
And when I'm using the TTs predominantly for that kind of darter style or fish head style.
Yeah.
And round, sometimes I like to use round ball heads.
Yeah.
And those are predominantly Gamakatsus.
Oh, okay. The round 29s and stuff like that. Is that what they are?
Yeah. Yeah, or around 25 or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And how do you go about working these and what sort of structure you throw on the mat predominantly?
So when we're not using, you know, technology to find those schools, just topping them down rock walls, to be honest.
Yeah, okay.
In and around rock walls, tea tree, rocky points, bits of current, anywhere really. Like they're just so versatile. And so on a 1/16, it really gives you a really good balance between being in the water column kind of long enough to get their attention,
yep,
but not so heavy that it just plummets down and gets stuck in amongst the rocks.
Yeah.
So it's really just such a versatile lure that you can throw around structure, bridges, pontoons, rock walls, flat. You can just do it all. There's just, the color range is fantastic. They're tough. You know, you can get 20, 30 fish out of one plastic.
Yep.
They're just hard to beat, especially anything with some UV and motor oil, just gun colors.
Yeah, okay. And Do you super glue them on or not?
I do, yeah.
I do, okay. Yeah.
Just using some Loctite gel.
Loctite gel, yep, that's the one. Yeah, I found that changes your how many plastics you go through. You find that they just last so much longer.
And the fact that if you get a take, you know you're not going to get pants and that fish is just going to come back anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Exactly, you get a hit, yep, and you're not worried about that lure down around the gape of the hook.
That's right. Yeah.
Perfect.
And then and just really quickly, we haven't really touched on it, but I am also a big proponent of scent.
Okay, cool.
So really big fan, especially on plastics. And my go-to is the Procure Bloody Tuna. I've been running that pretty religiously for good 4 or 5 years now, and I think it's been great.
Okay, cool.
You know, put that on the mast, put that on crabs. Sometimes I put that on the tail end of hard bodies as well.
Yeah.
It's a bit tough. So, yeah, I mean, really good stuff. It hangs on really well.
Yep.
Super stinky.
Yeah, what yeah. They love. Especially if you get it on yourself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll do those lines and leaders with your plastics. I know fishing different structures is going to give you different results, but generally, yeah. What are you going to throw your plastics on?
Look, generally speaking, for rock walls and flats, I'm using Miller Rod Scrub Freaks.
Yep.
So they're a 7'3" one piece rod. Ian's also now got the production range of rods.
Yeah.
So some of these that I'm talking about have been some customs that I had made before the production series came out.
Sure.
So I've got a mixture of production and customs. But both are absolutely fantastic, just super sensitive.
Yeah.
The blanks are just amazing in terms of sensitivity and feel.
Yeah.
The taper of those rods just allows you to make those nice long casts, irrespective, I guess, of your action, whether it's that smooth action, whether it's that really fast flick.
Yep.
Get it out a mile, you know, depending on the line setup, whether you're fishing straight through or braid.
Yep.
But with braid, I just find you feel every little bump and nibble and bite through that rod and reel outfit. Got them paired up with 2003 size Exist.
Yep.
And 10-pound braid. And generally running 4 or 5 pound leaders.
Okay, so 4 or 5 pound leader. Brands and makes, like, who do you use?
I'm a shocker for braids. I think I did a little Q&A the other day and someone had asked me the same question. And yep. I think I ended up with 6 brands.
Yeah, okay.
So I've run a lot of Unitika.
Yep.
I run Toray. I run Megabass. I run Gosen. I run Majorcraft.
Okay.
And there was something else. I think I'm missing one. And I ran X-Braid as well, that YGK X-Braid Australia.
Okay, so that's a bunch of different things. Is that because you haven't settled on what you love? Like, because that's what it is for me. Like, I'm still haven't, I mean, I use the Gosen a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, I'm still working through. I haven't found one of those super fine braids that I go, yep, that's the one.
Yeah, I'm looking at them now, just turned around. And when I was with Frogwiz offshore, the Unitake, I think it was Aga.
Yep.
Like a 10-pound four strand. I just think that was like one of the best, great all-round braids. Wasn't super expensive, wasn't anything kind of super fine.
Yeah.
It was just that really good balance between stiffness or softness and limpness.
Yeah, yeah.
It just tied knots really well. It just cast well and it just lasted for years.
Like, yeah.
Honestly, so I've got that on a few rods. But that's just getting harder and harder to find now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I still
And then
that.
I've started looking around and to be honest, you know, I'll find something on special and I'll just go and try it.
Yeah.
I just got some Megabass stuff out of Japan or it might have been more than or Saltiga brand. Dan Mackerel got me onto the Majorcraft.
Okay.
I think it was Dangan braid, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's the one I use too.
Yeah. And having a look at the specs of that versus some of the other brands, like super thin for its breaking strain.
Yeah.
So for anything that like, some of the qualities that I look for in a braid is really look for like at least an 8 strand these days.
Yeah.
And something that's thin, but I don't like to go below a 0.8 PE.
Okay.
I don't like the 0.6s. I find that I get more wind knot with them.
Yeah.
So I like anything 0.8 or 1 PE.
Okay.
And while that might seem 1 PE seems really heavy to people because I think that's equivalent of, 20 pound.
Yep.
And with technology these days, with 12 and 16 strand braids, so they're so thin that you can run them for brim, you can run them for snapper, you can run them for mulloway. It doesn't really matter. They're just great all rounders. So that's kind of what I look for, to be honest, in a braid these days. I don't like them too stiff.
Yeah.
So I do like a more supple braid.
Yeah, definitely. I know that sometimes when I change species, all I do is change the leader, take the same gear.
Yeah.
And off your total.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and you know, coming back to leaders as well, for big fish especially, there's been a lot of times at Mallacoota that I've been bitten off on plastics on 4 pound.
Yeah.
Where that, when the fish are on bait fish down there in that system, their teeth get really sharp.
Okay.
And 4 pound doesn't stand up to it some days.
Okay.
They're just sucking in these plastics.
Yeah.
And biting you off.
And chewing
off. Not actually flatties or tailor, they're just brim.
They're just
biting
brim.
You off.
So you would go to
a 5 or a 6 at that point.
5 or 6.
Just go up to that next millimeter diameter size. I think generally speaking, your 4 pound is like a 0.148 mil.
Yep.
And then I'll go up to that 1.65 or 1.8 mil 0.18 mil, yeah, or 0.165 mil.
Yeah. All right. I think that covers that pretty well. I'm going to pick one of the lures for you that you've mentioned. I can't remember whether it was this podcast or the last one you did with Greg. I want you to talk to me about stick minnows. I know you used a couple of different ones.
I have, yeah. I would say that I'm not really an expert on stickies, but I was a really big fan of the Atomic Semi-Hards for a while there. They're really good shimmy on the drop. And I think the whole idea behind them being soft really did allow for fish to come back.
Okay.
A lot of times, you know, your traditional TMCO or Oz Tackle or whatever it might have been, you know, you often just get one take at it or one go. They hit it, they feel that hard plastic and then generally don't come back. But with the Atomic Semi-Hards range, it was really good value for money. They shimmied well. They were just probably a touch heavy.
Yeah.
But caught some great fish over the years. And again, pretty similar kind of technique and concept as the mussel or the crab. It's really for us, and the way that I fish it and approach it is get really accurate casts in, really tight to structure.
Yeah.
Like a centimetre or two away from pontoons.
Yeah.
And generally I'll pick up a stick minnow if the fish are sitting up higher in the water column.
Okay.
So if I can see them, I can see heads or tails. If the water's relatively clean, I'll tend to go to a stick minnow. If the water's a little bit dirtier and I know the fish are sitting closer to the bottom, that's when I'll go to a crab or a mussel.
Okay. All right. And basically with the stick minnow, if you're fishing structure, it's basically just cast it out and let it sink. I assume you're not really twitching it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yes and no. You make a good point there. A lot of times there's something about those Atomic Semi-Hards where I could have the fish sitting under the boat for 10 or 15 twitches and then they'll still come back and eat it.
Right.
So I'd cast in tight to structure, nothing. But then I'd look down where my stick minnow is and there'd be two or three fish around it just sitting there as I twitch it. As it shimmies back down, they're around it, they're interested. And then finally one will just eat. There's just something about that stick minnow that vertically they really like the action.
Okay.
And so it's worthwhile when you are fishing them to observe what's happening as you get closer to the boat. And don't be afraid to drop them back down out of sight.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point where, you know, in the water column, depending on clarity, that you tend to lose it.
Yeah.
Not able to observe it. And oftentimes that's where they're sitting.
Yeah.
They're sitting just out of view where they can't see you. You can't see them.
Yeah.
But as that stick minnow sinks back down, oftentimes they'll grab it.
They'll grab
it.
It's
just out of sight. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. It's one you kind of have to concentrate on because your natural response is to probably pull that back in and cast again.
So. To wind it in, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And likewise, I think you and I spoke last time around some systems in Gippsland where we're getting a lot of fish right under the boat with soft plastics.
Yeah.
And very similar technique, just off the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember you saying that on one of your videos. They were taking it as you change the action from a more horizontal action as the lure comes back to the boat and then it turns a bit more vertical and that's when the fish grab it.
That's right, yeah.
All right. I think we're going to leave the lures there because we're well over time, which is really good. Now, we've spoken about your sponsor in Lowrance. Is there anyone else you want to talk about and give a shout-out to?
Oh, I mean, massive shout-out to Ian at Miller Rods.
Yep.
Ian supported me for a number of years and, yeah, huge thank you to him. He's got a great range of production rods out now covering all scenarios, super popular all around the country with, you know, offshore guys, with cod fishermen and all bass and brim guys. And that range is only going to be expanding this year and years to come. So he's been working on a lot of new products. So really excited about continuing to work with Ian. Hoping to do a rod giveaway as well.
Nice.
In the coming kind of weeks or next month or so. So just working out the finer details on that with Ian.
Yep.
Stay tuned for that.
Yeah. We'll circle back to that in a minute.
What's that? Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
And a huge thanks to Scott Loving at SLH.
Sure.
So Scott Loving Hobie down here in Victoria in Mornington.
Yep.
Big thanks to Scotty for helping out with the PA14 360.
Yeah.
But then I got in touch a couple of years ago together and worked on getting that Hobie all set up and decked out. So yeah, big thanks to Scotty.
Yep. How long have you had that?
I got that probably about 18 months ago now.
Andrew. Okay. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're well versed in it. It's a pretty cool boat or kayak.
Oh, I came from like a 2013 model.
Yep.
PA14 with no reverse. And so 360 is just game changing for me. Like people say it, but it is.
No, it really is. Next level. And same with kick-ups. Kick-ups are amazing.
Yes.
So, yeah. Kick-up fins for people who don't know.
Yeah. The only thing that I'm missing is a power pole. I think that will be the next and last upgrade for that boat.
Yeah, ring Scotty. He'll sort you out.
I was looking, going through the photos of the boys rigging the AC boat.
Yeah.
All the photos of the power poles just made me go, yeah, I definitely need one for next season. So it's going to be the next upgrade.
Yeah, I think they're pretty cool. And they do plug into your Lowrance sounder so you can control them straight from your screen.
That's
too.
Right.
How cool is that?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So you've got Lowrance, Scotty Lovick, Miller Rods. Anyone else?
Yeah, Chris at GFAB Engineering. A lot of the active target poles, sounder mounts, things like that. Chris has been super helpful, helped me with some installs, with some content and some product as well towards both the kayak and the boat. So, awesome. Yeah, massive shout out to Chris at GFAB Engineering. He's located down here in Victoria, in the kind of northern suburbs or just out of Melbourne, about an hour out of Melbourne. But the quality of welding and fabrication work that comes out of that workshop is just second to none. So, there's other pole manufacturers around the country, but I find that Chris has really found a really good sweet spot in terms of like the diameter and the fit and finish of his product.
Yep.
I think some of the other ones, especially for the kayak side of things, is a little bit over-engineered. They're too big, they're too bulky.
Yeah.
And whereas Chris's products at GFAB Engineering, I think he's just got that sweet spot in terms of diameter, weight, and fit and finish of all the little bits and pieces for adjustments.
Yeah.
They look the part and they work the part too.
Yeah, and he'll ship around the country?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, he ships out. And I guess the last one's massive thanks to Marty at Burley Pro as well.
Yeah.
So for the kayak guys and got plenty of accessories all around the country.
Yeah.
Marty supported me for a number of years now. He's just a champion bloke.
Yeah.
An awesome small business story and one we should all kind of get behind.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. He's done a lot for kayaks and not just here in Australia, but I think he ships a lot of stuff around the world, I think.
He does. Yeah, both to America and New Zealand and all around the world. He's just a champion guy and go out of his way to help anyone.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, mate. So as we bring this to a close, I'll ask you one final question in just a minute, mate, but it has been epic. Definitely, I think I could have talked to you probably for another hour. There's a bunch of questions we didn't even get to.
Sorry for going off on tangents on some questions.
No, but that's kind of what I wanted to do. We're trying to drill into those intricacies and things that to help people catch bigger brim. And hopefully we've done that. So it's been epic, mate. You've shared a lot. So look, in final, like for a final thing to offer a listener, what would your advice be to anglers who are trying to upgrade the class of brim they're catching? Have you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, I do. I thought about this one. Not going to be an easy answer. It's time on the water.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it comes down to at the end of the day, Andrew. Like, you can crack a pattern for a weekend or a month or a period of the year or a certain section of a system, that you can consistently, there's good fish, but to consistently either go around the state or go around the country and identify those spots that generally hold those bigger fish.
Yeah.
It really comes down to time on the water and having faith in your electronics. So, while we chatted about lures, like there's so many stories. Like you said, we could chat for another hour or two about this sort of stuff. But just one really quick final story. Like Mallacoota 3-4 years ago, Vic Broom Classic in June, July. So we were doing the usual stuff that we've just been talking about, rock walls, deep. And then there was just one stretch for whatever reason we were idling and saw five good shadows, five good fish on the side imaging.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I had a 2-inch grub tied on.
Yeah.
I've rarely fished something so small. The water was relatively clear. It was like on a 1/6 jig head. So it was a really strange combination for me. I don't remember why I had that.
Yeah.
But using that technology and going, they're brim for sure. Punched out a cast and they were a long way out too.
Yeah.
And sure enough, a 1.3 yellowfin.
Wow.
Pucked it off the like, for whatever reason, just having that confidence in your technology, I guess a bit of luck or knowing what to pick up and throw when.
Yeah.
But that comes down to time on the water. That comes down to experience. And the other biggest tip, if you can, and if you're like really keen, get out there and start exploring systems that aren't your locals or aren't your favorite.
Yeah, okay.
Like, it's all well and good to get 5-6 kilograms at your local on a Saturday or midweek.
Yeah.
When there's no one there. Yep. But go and fish a really tough system 400 Ks away, and I guarantee that you'll learn more and put that in the memory bank towards future trips and comps than you will if you just went to your local safe spot.
Yeah, yeah,
definitely. Go and fish them in those shit conditions. Yeah. You know, that's the best bit of advice that I can give anyone who's either starting out or wants to consistently catch better than average size fish. And that's what I was doing in my 20s. So it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
I just loved it. It was when I had the Skeeter, before I had, you know, bigger commitments, I was able to get away 3 out of 4 weekends a month.
Yeah, okay.
And it's gonna travel all around Victoria. Yeah. And I'd be away from Friday night and I'd be back Sunday night.
Back Sunday night, go to work and wait for the next weekend.
Yep, and do it again. Exactly right. So, and again, that's not for everyone. That's not realistic. But ultimately, to build up that level of knowledge of times of year, different systems, different patterns, different weather conditions, structures.
Yep.
That's what it's. But with technology, with some of the lure choices these days as well, like, that's out of sight better than what it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to agree.
If I knew what I know today, 10, 15 years ago, like,
mm-hmm.
would have been mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So unfortunately, there's no easy answer. No, like, yeah, just go and do this and throw this there. But if you invest the time and learn to use your electronics, I think you'll be a far greater fisherman. You'll start to pick up and put the pieces together of that puzzle towards where am I going to find these fish? How am I going to tempt them? And how am I going to get them in the boat?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's sound advice. I mean, if you follow anyone that follows the competition scene knows that it's the same people up the top nearly all the time. You know, they just kind of rotate. So it's not luck.
Yep.
It's practice and effort and all that sort of stuff and time on the water.
Yeah. I will say that the level of competition, again, in the last 3 to 5 years in both the boats and the kayaks has gone up another level.
It has. The fish are bigger now. It's simple as that. Like, we're catching bigger fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're catching bigger fish. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily because the fish are growing bigger. That may be a little bit the case, but more just that I think the anglers generally are better.
Totally agree with that.
Well, there you go. All right. So where can people reach out to you if they want to ask you a question or get in contact with you? What's the best on your socials?
The easiest one's probably Instagram.
Yep.
So you can find me on all the major socials, really. Like, on Facebook, I've got Paul Maloff Fishing, on Instagram, Paul Maloff Fishing, and on YouTube, Paul Maloff Fishing as well. No TikTok, no Twitter, but catch me on any of those. And I would love to hear from you. Love to hear some questions. Hopefully you can get involved in the upcoming giveaway.
Yep.
So I do pretty much a monthly giveaway on my Facebook fishing page,
yep.
Paul Maloff Fishing. I give away a whole bunch of lures, braid, merchandise, that kind of stuff.
Yep. And how's that work?
I've worked it out, but I've probably given about 80 or 90 packs away over the years now. I've been running my fishing page for 8 years or over 8 years now.
Yep.
I think I started this around the time or just before or just after Hobie World.
Yeah.
And every month I guess, you know, we've been relatively successful over the years and had a bit of luck where we've won some prize packs.
Yep.
I haven't sold any of that stuff. I've just given it away.
Nice. How do you actually give it away? What do you do?
Yeah. So I put up the prize pack for the month and just ask anyone who follows the page or who's a subscriber to type in pick me. As in the comment section.
Yep.
So all I do is type out the name of everyone who has entered the draw by typing in pick me.
Yep.
On that particular post. And then I use a random name generator or that random name selector online so they can see all the entries as I do the live draws as well. So
yeah.
It's a very quick competition and I don't drag them out. About 3 days to kind of enter. And then I draw the winner live every time.
Perfect.
I think I've probably given away about 10 grand of product over those years, I'd say, comfortably.
Yeah, and like you said, hopefully Ian's going to step up to the plate and give you something fantastic to offer the listeners or viewers, as it may be.
Exactly. Yeah, that one's going to be a YouTube giveaway. So I'm going to do some more stuff on YouTube to try and promote the channel a little bit more.
Yeah.
And hopefully work with the Lawrence on doing something similar as well. So stay tuned for that. Jump onto YouTube if you're not already a subscriber. It really helps the channel out. and will help to do more future giveaways like this.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. All right. Well, there you go, listeners. Mr. Paul Malov, there's been a wealth of information there. Lots of stuff to go back through. Have a look at your sounders. Get onto YouTube. Have a look at his page there. And, yeah, get studying, get practicing, spend some time on the water. And from Paul and myself, I'll bid you good night.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast. I hope you got some great value from today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. In fact, wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure you subscribe to ALF. And for show notes, downloads, maps, and other free resources, make sure you go to doclures.com and check out what we've got for ALF listeners there. Until the next episode, stay safe, tight lines, and may the fish be with you.